There've been times that people have asked me what I do for a living, and in humor, a few times I've said, "Well, I'm a moth gynecologist." And you know, after this talk this evening, the name may stick. I don't know, but we're going to do this, and with your help, I hope we can resolve maybe a few issues. I think we'll start by looking at this very well-known cladogram by Christensen, where the major superfamilies are shown. And I think when most people, most lepers, when they look at this cladogram, probably would be most impressed by the fact that the Dytrisia is such a successful group. And of course, here again, the term Dytrisia itself refers to female structures. So we're going to see a lot of major definitions here, certainly in superfamilies, pertaining to the female genitalia, which is a very important set of characters in the Lepidoptera, which may not be so true in other orders of insects. When I look at this cladogram, I'm more impressed, of course, at the basal families, because I look there and I see that's where all the action has occurred. And we're looking at, you know, like 200 million years of results of evolutionary development within this order. And you go to the basal groups and you see all these neat steps, major gaps. Then you get to the Dytrisia and everything seems to sort of flatten out. But in the lower groups, we do have some rather interesting developments. So this is going to be the most of the clades that I'll be talking about today. And the other thing that I always marvel at when I'm looking at a cladogram like this, and I wonder, you know, just how much extinction has occurred. What are we missing? I think in this area of the Lepidoptera, there'll probably be still more families discovered lurking out there with a single species, you know. This is something I'll be repeating over and over again, is how small some of these families are. It's because, and this is why we have these very noticeable gaps, so much extinction has occurred. And so we now are left with just a sample of what was. One thing we probably should first talk about is this term ovipositor, because Lepidopters, particularly taxonomists, myself included, we use this term very matter of fact, when actually the ovipositor, and it's been pointed out by many people, in Lepidoptera truly is not homologous to the true insect ground plan ovipositor, which is more typical in some of the orthopteroid groups. And this is a Tetragoneid, and which is known for extremely large ovipositor. What I've seen in some glossaries are definitions that actually fit fairly well if you're using either term. And the ovipositor is simply defined as by Tuckson. Then he recognizes that there are two types of ovipositors: the oviscaf, which is formed by the prolongation, the modification of the posterior abdominal segments. This is the Lepidoptera type, and also the Trichoptera type. And then the appendicular type of ovipositor, which is formed by these large appendages, mainly from the eighth and ninth segments. Particularly the terms they use are valvuli. Sometimes they refer to them as gonopophyses. The trichopterists use usually oviscape, or oviscap. Lepidopterists use ovipositor. I probably will continue using ovipositor, even though I realize it's not truly homologous to the ground plan. Starting with the Trichoptera, because after all they are the sister group of the Lepidoptera and together make up this major clade, the Amphismenoptera, we see in the plesiomorphic state with the, you wanted me to use the pointer maybe.
Yeah, just don't hit the button.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right, okay. In the Trichoptera, in the plesiomorphic state, particularly in the Rhycophyllids in the lower part of the Trichoptera, the eighth and ninth segments are a single cylinder. They're not subdivided into a dorsal, ventral, tergite, sternite. But in the higher families of Trichoptera, they are divided. You'll see two pairs of apophyses from the 8th and from the 9th segment. There's at least one genus of Trichoptera that has three sets of apophyses, and we may say more about that later. You'll notice the cerci, small pair of cerci, which are lost in the Lepidoptera. We look at the internal plumbing of the Trichoptera, which tends to be fairly consistent through the order. And this is fairly similar in a general way to some of the most basal aglossatin Lepidoptera, particularly the family Micropterygidae. We find there is a short cloaca, which is formed by the junction of the alimentary canal and the genital chamber. The genital chamber is formed by the junction of several genital ducts, such as the oviduct. Here we see the oviduct coming in ventrally, and then the versicopulatrix and the spermatheca, all joining more or less together to form this enlargement, which we call normally the genital chamber. Now, the genital chamber in Lepidoptera can be, you know, termed various things. You're going to see vestibulum. I'll be using probably all these terms today indiscriminately sometimes. Vagina, vestibulum, and so on. The spermatheca in a Trichoptera, by the way, is greatly enlarged usually, much larger than the corpus bursae normally. Now we come to the colorized version, which has appeared in recent works, especially in this fine book on the evolution of the insects, taken from a Scobel's diagram showing the three major types of Lepidoptera, the female reproductive system, starting with the monotrisian type, the exoporian, and the ditrisian. The ditrisia, of course, are remarkable because there is a connection, an internal connection, between the versicopulatrix and the oviduct, and the other two lack this internal connection. There is some variation that has developed in the monotrisian type, which I'll talk a little bit about today, and also the exoporian type. The exoporian type is most renowned, you might say, for having an extremely short oviscape or ovipositor. The terminal segments are quite short. There is no apophyses. And there is a groove, an external sperm track or sperm canal, which is open to the exterior that connects the ostium bursae with the ovipore. And that is usually the prime distinction of this exoporian type genitalia, but you're going to see today in at least one genus there is some modification here. Let's start with the Micropterygidae, which is the basal group of the Lepidoptera, and everybody agrees to that. This is the oldest extant living group of Lepidoptera today. The adults have chewing mouth parts, articulated mandibles, and they feed on pollen and spores of ferns. Looking at the ovipositor of the Micropterygidae, you see most of all that's very characteristic of the family is the fact that the 9th and 10th segments are well-defined and are separate. This is the only family of Lepidoptera where the 10th segment is distinct and separate from the 9th. In all other families, there's various degrees of fusion between these segments. The spermatheca enters the genital chamber, much like you saw in the Trichoptera with the oviduct coming in ventrally. The spermatheca duct is simple in Micropterygidae, which means there is no coiling and there's no subdivision of this duct into, say, an internal or external or efferent canals. The 9th segment is usually an intact ring in Micropterygidae, but in at least two genera, Micropterix and Sabatinka, the tergum is unsclerotized and is, we say, simply missing. The heterobathmiids are a very small family of about 9 species, one genus, which are restricted to southern Andean forests of South America. The apophyses are essentially absent in this family. The posterior apophyses are sometimes a small rudiment can be detected here. I've lost my, here we go. This would be about all that's remaining of the posterior apophyses. We go over to the spermafecal duct, and we see a division beginning here. This is the first instance of a subdivision of the spermafecal duct. And you have a thickened portion and a membranous portion, two separate canals. There is no cloaca, and a very large dental chamber proportioned to the other structures here. A cloaca is present only in the Micropterygidae and the Agathophagidae, forms which have developed long piercing ovipositors, such as the aerocranioid grade, which consists of three families, and hopefully it'll go back to the same place. So anyway, in the aerocranioid grade of three families, cloaca is present, and also in the heteroneuron monotrisian family, the incurvarioidea, you have cloaca, very long cloaca developed. Okay, but in the heterobathmiids, cloaca is absent. The Agathophagid is a family of one genus and two species, occurring only in Australia and islands off the coast of Australia. The larvae are seed feeders on Agathis. Extremely interesting family morphologically. And I'd like to acknowledge these slides, the next couple of slides from Christensen and Hunfeld, who gave a presentation at the last meetings of the European Lepidopterist Conference in Germany. They have been working on homologies, particularly of the apophyses within the Agathophagidae, because it's a very strange situation here. You see, the apophyses are present. They were absent in the Micropterygidae and very poorly developed, if at all present, in their heterobathmiids. But in the Agathophagids, you have a long posterior apophyses, which is fused for nearly half its length. And the anterior apophyses, you not only have a pair, you have two pair. You have a ventral and dorsal pair. So Niels was hoping to determine the homology of these anterior apophyses. And he immediately turned to the musculature, hoping to homologize these structures based on the muscles. And lo and behold, he found there were 24 sets of muscles that he could identify in the Agathophagid post-abdomen. And comparing it to Trichoptera and also Aerocraneas, which were one of the closest morphological groups to these Agathophagids, he found much fewer muscles. So he ended up, his concluding statements were essentially that we couldn't do it, we can't homologize these structures, and so there are two scenarios. You have the these anterior pair either fusing to form the anterior pair that you see throughout practically all of Lepidoptera, or we could even be looking at a three apophyses base ground plan feature, because like I say, there is at least one genus of Trichoptera that also have a double pair, anterior pair of apophyses. A lot of work, and really, he was back to square one, essentially. Aerocraneids are a group, like I say, have a well-developed cloaca, as you can see here. The Posterior apophyses are fused apically and usually depressed to form a cutting edge. The eggs are inserted into the plant directly. The characteristic, the main characteristic of iriocorneas are the presence of this vaginal sclerite. And this is a large sclerite, which is often species-specific, which encloses the genital chamber at this point. And also there are large muscle attachments to this vaginal sclerite. You'll notice that in the spermatothecal duct there is a well-developed, a rather well-developed a thickened chamber or canal, plus the membranous type. Also in iriocorneids you have a first appearance of these possibly ventral apophyses. And you'll see these appear a few times, even in Dytrisia. And you'll see they're very short apophyses, probably of the ninth segment, usually on either side of the ovipore. They're present in acanthopterocteids, but are absent in the lophocoronids, which are another group that's related superficially to the iriocorneids. Here you see more views of the vaginal sclerite. It's a very peculiar structure in the abdomen of these females. In this family, you see again the ventral apophyses near the apex. The main characteristic that we found so far have been the spermatothecal papilla, which is usually either musculature or muscles or just a very membranous outgrowth from the genital tract. In the acanthopterocteids, it's sclerotized, usually in the shape of a foam. And the spermatothecal duct is simple without any differentiation. The Neoceuses are a weird family. Of course, most of these things are weird, I guess. You have to admit that right off the bat. Again, these are all living fossils, which makes them really fascinating. To me, Neoceuses, even when I saw my first one, looked more like a broad-winged Neuropterin rather than some Lepidopterin. The wings are very thinly scaled, almost hair-like. And the really interesting feature about them that Niels Christensen and Evy Nielsen found is when they sectioned the proboscis, they found instead of the normal central channel that's formed when the two galea come together in nearly, well, all Glossata, instead they found a double tube configuration. Each galea has its own little tube. The female genitalia of Neoceuses are unusual too because the anterior apophyses are gone. They're absent. The posterior apophyses are fused at the apex and somewhat depressed to form a rasping or a digging organ. We know nothing about the biology of this family. I keep hoping someday someone like Shin, that's in your area, Shinhorn. He's got one species in Taiwan, which is very difficult to collect. Someday someone is going to find the larva of this and learn a little bit about its oviposition as well. My idea is that this kind of apophysis, of course, is not, this kind of cutting tool is not for deep penetration. It's really for rasping or digging. And I suspect the biology of the egg-laying part of it is somewhat similar to a species of Prodoxid, a genus Parategeticula. We'll look at that later. There is no actual cloaca in this group. The other unusual feature about the females is that you'll notice this very prominent pocket in the seventh and eighth sterna. Especially notice the sclerotization and the roughness of the of this pocket on the seventh sternum. This to me is like a grasping almost organ. Maybe it helps to anchor the abdomen during this digging process. But again, this is all conjecture. We have no idea really what these things do or what they feed on. Also, I'd be very interested in seeing what the larvae of the Neoceuses look like. I think that would be fascinating. I've always been impressed with a paper that Niels and Ebbe Nielsen did together on the genus Fraus, an Australian hippialid. It has some really nice sagittal sections that a technician of Niels was very good at doing, as well as cross sections. Because again, this is in your exoporia. This is where you find that peculiar sperm track. And if you look over in the right picture here, this is the sperm track, and these are the intergenital lobes, which are a little bit difficult to homologize. We don't really, I haven't seen any good homological arguments made for these. But these two lobes, which are filled with muscles, form this groove by which the sperm travel, again, from the ductus ostium to up to the oviduct. This is another family of Hippialoidea, another exoporium, which shows the major features of the group. As I said before, the abdomen is very abbreviated, condensed, and so we have this what is simply called a dorsal plate, which is the ninth and tenth terga, and then you have a ventral plate, which is a counterpart of that. And you can see more or less where the sperm tract is located, which is ventral to the anal opening. You'll see a well-coiled spermatecal duct with two channels, as well as a very prominent papilla. The really strange thing in the Hippialoidea is this genus Osroides, which is known only from one species, collected in Colombia from just a few specimens. Fortunately, we have males and females, though, and that's about it. I think they were probably collected nearly 100 years ago and haven't been found since. Osroides is an even more intermediate condition with dytrisia. It approaches a dytrisian condition very carefully. You find this ductus seminalis, in quotes. It's an internal tube. It's not this groove that you saw in the other hippialids. There's an internal groove which connects the ductus bursae, continues almost to the ovipore, and it ends in a small chamber just ventral to the ovipore. A most unusual situation, but if you look at the venation, you see, yep, it's a homoneurous moth. It's got, you know, four RS branches in the hind wing, so it's in there somewhere, but we need to know more about it. The Protothiorids is one genus, nine species, known only from South Africa, and the unusual process, the unusual feature of this family is that the females possess what I have called a conjugal process. And again, this is more conjecturing on my part. No one has ever witnessed the copulation of these. They should, because there are processes involved here which look like an interlocking mechanism. I don't know what else to think about them. But this process is often species-specific between those nine species. You look at the male, and you'll see that there is this sclerite they call the trillium in the Hippialoids, which is fused to the tip of the juxta, the dorsal part of the juxta. And in this trillium, there is a very noticeable groove. And inside there is a pouch, which I call the conjugal pouch. So it's my idea that this process has to fit inside this pouch of the trillium in these. And so we've got the tips of the abdomens locked, perhaps in a rather prolonged copulation to transport this spermatophore. I jokingly have said also that it's the only moth group that I know that where the female has an intermittent organ and the male has lacks it. Because in the Hippialoids, the ediagus is, there is no sclerotized ediagus, it's a simple membranous phallus. Now we come to the heteroneura. This is the Monotrysia heteroneura, which is doubtfully monophyletic group. It has two major divisions in it based on just the female morphology. You have one group that have a soft non-piercing ovipositor, and another group that has these long, very long apodemes, apophyses, and they are used for piercing into the plant to lay their eggs. This is an example of the family Opistegidae of one of the ones with soft ovipositors. The anterior apophyses are lacking in most of the genera, and the you see there are a pair of anal papillae here. In the Opistegids, the sperma theca is a rather strange thing, which really needs more studying. And I would encourage anyone to pay more attention to this structure. It is can vary quite a bit, even within a family. And in the Opistegids, for example, within this one genus, this membranous canal, the afferent canal, originates on the corpus bursae. It does this on several species, but not all. And then this internal canal, the sclerotized part, then meets it, and it starts their characteristic intertwining down to this small sclerotic they call the vesicle. Another odd thing about Pseudopistega, and I'll put this as a question to anyone here, we find these external tubercles on the corpus bursa, and I have no idea what they're for. Most of the species of Pseudopistega have them. The corpus bursa is covered with a sheet of muscles, and we know there are cases where there are stigma that actually penetrate right through the wall, and I'm sure there are muscles attaching to some of these knob-like projections of the stigma in many of the higher dicotrysia. Possibly these things are simply muscle attachments to it, but I don't know. If anyone has any ideas, I'd like to hear it. One of the strangest spermatheca I've found was in a species I studied from Malaysia. Only one female known. And here you see the spermatheca is enlarged. It's even larger than the corpus bursae. The internal canal curls around the external canal. But the external canal is inflated. And inside this probably is remnants or part of the structure that we call the receptaculum, or the receptaculum gland. On the right here, we see the noctuid agrotis that Dugdale illustrated in his fine 1974 review of female morphology in the Lepidoptera. And this is more or less a standard example, I think, of what we think of when we see the spermatheca. Some people refer to the these large sacs as being the spermatheca. I usually refer to the entire structure, with the utriculus usually being the sac where the sperm is actually being stored, and you see a receptacular gland extending off from that very narrow thing. Sometimes at the base of the utriculus you see lateral projections, either tubular or saccular, and this is often referred to, as Dugdale did, as a lagina. And then you see these canals.
Is that typical for a lot of Opistegids in that spermatheca type?
You mean joining the corpus bursae?
Large size. In
relation
to the corpus bursae.
Let's see. Which part are you talking about? The following slide?
Yeah. Is that an unusual case?
Oh, here?
Yeah.
No, this is only one female.
Okay.
Yeah, of Opistegoides. And like I say, one specimen, one female. And I've never seen it in any other Opistegid or any other moth, as far as that goes. The Paleophadids are about 60 species, 7 genera, and they're present both in South America, again in this sort of Patagonia area, the southern austral South America, such an exciting place to work. I've spent 5 months there looking for everything I could. Ebby spent a lot of time, at least that amount of time. I suspect this family also occurs in South Africa because the larvae, are, as far as we know, are feed only on Proteaceae, another nice Gondwanian plant group. And the eggs are laid on the leaves, underside of leaves usually, and they're coated with a gelatinous material, much like Nepheculid eggs are. And the larvae then becomes leaf miners, and then they start to skeletonize. They break up the mine and become skeletonizers. The one thing I wanted to point out here with Paleophades, it's probably an autapomorphy for the family, is this median sensory ridge, I call it. They have these sensory structures on the surface of this structure from the tense segment. I assume they're campaniform sensilli. The ovipore can be quite broad, at least in the genus Paleophades. But other than that, there's no cloaca, and it's like superficial, like some of the other heteronervin monotrysia. One thing that's often true with many of the Paleophades is that there's a great deal of sclerotization inside the corpus bursae, often in the forms of spicules. And I even find them in the utriculus. And I ask you this, has anyone seen any sclerotization like this in the utriculus of the Spermatheca? It's the only family that I know of. You'll see some well-formed spermatophores here. You would think when a spermatophore passes through this structure, which here I've called the colliculum, often called the antrum, and other names as well. Cestum has been used. It's the sort of sclerotized part of the ductus bursae. You would think it looks like a meat grinder in the Paleophades. You wonder, how does a spermatophore get through that without being disintegrated? But you find intact spermatophores.
Could you go to two slides back?
Two?
This one, yes. I was just wondering what makes this monotrysia, this structure. I maybe missed some from this point.
You have, let's see, where do we have it? You have the ovipore right here, and there is no separate copulatory opening. This is true with all of these monotrysian heteronervins. They're just, in other words, you have two openings at the end of the body. You have the anal opening and you have the ovipore, which can be used, various terms have been used for that. Gonopore has been used. But there is no ostium bursa. We won't run into that until we get to the diatrysia. So here's the meat grinder, the colliculum. Tishoreids, a lot of work really needs to be done on the female Tishoreids. I would hope somebody would do something like Christensen did with the sagittal sections, because the posterior of the body, these are very small moths, leaf miners most of the time. The posterior of the body, the segments are very compressed, so it's difficult really to detect the borders and to figure out what segment is which. But basically, it's a system like the Paleophades and the Opisthagen. In the Tishoreids, you have two well-developed and easily discernible apodemes or apophyses, but also you may have as many as two or three other pairs, and these are developed from the eighth and the ninth segment. They can be plate-like, they can be ribbon-like. It's questionable as to what they really are homologous to. In this species here, you have only the two pair. The Andesiana, there's just one genus and three species that occur in southern South America. They're rather large. They are the largest of all the monotrysian heteronurin. These things will go maybe 2.5 inches across the wing. They look like cossets. In fact, all three species were first described as cossetae in the diatrysia. And Patricia brought these specimens to me. She says, "Don, I can't place these in consists. Could you look at them?" So I dissected the females, and no wonder. I said, "They're monotrysian." They even have a short cloaca. And again, we know nothing about them. typical, you know, we have no idea what the larvae look like or what they feed on. Very frustrating at times. Here is the blow up of the genitalia. They do have anal papillae, like the Opisthagens do. The Paleophades do not have such distinct papillae like that. Now we come to that group of the heteronurin monotrysia that have piercing ovipositors. And this, of course, is the Yakamoth group, the Tegetikla, which Uli Palmier is doing such a great job in unraveling. In the bottom left, you have a female ovipositing in the ovary, and the eggs are laid beside the developing ovules, and eventually they will consume usually a part of that crop. The genus I mentioned, though, that is atypical for these prodoxins, is this genus Paratagaticula. And even before this genus was named, I saw specimens in our collection, and I looked at the ovipositor and I thought, holy hell, what is this? You know, what's this thing doing, you know, because it's not like all the other ovipositors in the prodoxins. I wanted to get out to Arizona and try to find these things, and I did. And I saw the females ovipositing in the inflorescence of the yucca flower, and it would take her a long time to create a row, sometimes maybe 30 eggs across. It's a single row of eggs, and she simply keeps boring. I watched her, just that abdomen is working around and around and around, and she's just digging in, and then she plops one egg, and then she moves over slightly and starts another pit right beside it. Sometimes it would probably take an hour to form some of these rows. I suspect Neosuchus do something like this also, but I don't know. Jerry Powell was successful in following the larvae after they hatched from the eggs, and found that instead of being stem borers, or like the genus Prodoxys, that they actually found their way to the ovary and bored in and became seed feeders also. They also pollinate the yucca. They have these special maxillary tentacles that the Tegetikla possesses. And you see the anterior ends of the posterior apophyses are greatly flattened, which are the attachments of some fairly powerful muscles. I show this other family, Adelidae, which is another member of the Incurvarioidea, with the very long antennae in the males, simply to show this complexity that you see in the abdomen when you open these up. Again, this is a group where you have a very long ovipositor that can thrust out some distance, and it has to drag all these organs with it. Well, to drag them back, you have quite an elaborate arrangement of these, what Dugdale called guy wires. I simply call them tendons, and it actually may be, these tendons seem to be more developed in the RSA and the other incurvarioids. It's been suggested that they may actually be a synapomorphy for the family. Now we get to the Dytrisia, and this is almost going to end my talk because you all know Dytrisia. Nothing happens in Dytrisia except lots of species, lots of genera. But I wanted to show this one. This is a genus I worked on, Ishnaridia, which occurs in Southeast Asia. It has perhaps the longest ovipositor or ovescape that I know of, proportional to the size of the body. These apophyses go way up into the thorax when they're at rest. And again, we know nothing or practically nothing about the biology. This is a very rare group. I've collected them in the Philippines, in Mindanao, and I have one specimen in the National Museum, a different species that was found in the leaf sheaths of banana. So I said, oh ho, perhaps if both of the things are laying their eggs deep into even the banana stalk or at least the leaf sheaths. And it'd be interesting to know just how far in this ovipositor goes. You don't have a long tool like that if you're not going to use it. There could be a more hidden site, you know, like in a leaf sheath, and that would actually help to have a longer ovipositor. But anyway, a very interesting group with very dimorphic male and female. In the South America, there are probably 55 or more species now listed in the genus Tinea, and about 50 of them don't belong there. They're either new genera or will go to other genera. But there is a core group of true Tinea that occur down the Andean mountain chain all the way to Chile and Argentina. One characteristic of many of the species, there's actually two groups of these, but one group have very dark wings. This is one of the most colorful ones. They're usually solid dark, and they occur at elevations of over 2,000 meters. And one of the odd thing about them is that the larvae are the adults, females are larviparous. And in Tinea, You see, typical tinea here, this is one of this group that's not larviferous. So this is your typical tinea with very long oviscate, long apophyses. When you get to the larviferous ones, because the larvae are simply pop out, you have a very shortened oviscate. And this section of the genital chamber, which often is called the vestibulum, or in this group, particularly the uterus. But as far as we know, there is no nourishment given to the larva as it's held here. And then the first instar larvae are eventually expelled, and you'll see some females with a totally empty vestibulum. And this one here to the left, I suspect that the larvae have not descended, and therefore they have not expanded this vestibulum. Or else I can't expand this rather reduced situation. I've found as many as about 95 larvae in the vestibulum of these. The Rhenophanidae is a group that's found in the Neotropics and also the Old World in the Southeast Asia and in Australia. One point I like to make here is simply, and again I would like to know what other families have this kind of development. In this case it's the ductus seminalis. Look how long that ductus seminalis is. In this particular genus, and this genus is a member of the more derived members of the family. It's not a basal group at all. It's the more derived, which has this long development of the ductus seminalis. You'll find that the vesica of the male in this genus, which is partly sclerotized, has largely broken off. And you can follow how far the vesica protruded through this seminal duct before mating ceased. So you look at the male and you see this whopper of a vesica, which is in this particular case, because it's partly sclerotized, cannot be withdrawn into the ediagus, but instead is stored in a special sac called the apotheca. It's coiled like a watch spring, and one reason of this coiling is that the sclerotization is on one side and it causes this thing to coil. In specimens that either have tried to mate or have been have died expelling their inner contents, you'll see this vesica all intertwined around the abdomen, and it can be seven times as long as the body of the moth itself. So anyway, I'd like to know if there's any other specializations like that in other Lepidoptera. I come to the Cycadae because here again is the most derived of the 10 known subfamilies of cycads, the Oecetacinae, where the females have not only lost their wings, they've lost everything. Their larva form, no appendages whatsoever. The eggs are laid inside the case and the larvae leave and start ballooning and do whatever they can to disperse. Female is a bag of eggs, which may lay up to as many as 12,000 eggs. You go to the male and you'll see an elongated vesica, which is stored in the base of the ediagus. And you'll see again a very elongated ductus seminalis. And again, this is true for the most derived families of subfamilies of the cycads and not the any of the basal groups. This is my last one, which Dave has spent some time with too, since he's reviewing the paper. This is a new species of cycad from Panama. The genus actually occurs also in Brazil and other places, southern South America. The larvae are predaceous. That's interesting, yes. Some cycads do that. But the really interesting thing is, and this is a female fully winged, as many of the primitive cycads are. The really interesting thing is that the eggs are laid encapsulated in a little cocoon-like case. And you see these, they're usually about 15 to 30 or 35 of these in a little ball, which are laid probably, we think, on the trunks of trees and things like that, rather exposed, in other words, in a cluster. And this, the seedy from these cocoons are spun from the corythogen hairs at the tip of the abdomen. And these hairs are triangular, which again causes them to sort of curl, gives them a natural curl. And they are also barbed, which means they stick together like Velcro. So this facilitates, of course, on how these cocoons are made. But the question is, how does a female do this and why? Why are these eggs like this? Because this may be a unique case for all insects. I don't know of another insect that encapsulates each egg in a sort of identical cocoon, and does it so neatly. Part of the answer, I'm sure, is in the female genitalia, where you find an extra pair of apophyses, ventral apophyses, which is, I'm sure, homologous to the what we used to call, anyway, the ventral pseudopophyses in a teneoidea, which is often present in many things that have these long telescoping ovipositors. They're usually embedded in the wall. In this case, the apophyses, the ventral apophyses, are free and are attached to undoubtedly powerful muscles. And I think this extra set of apophyses, which only occurs in this one group that do these unusual A's, are essential for this process. We have not observed this, unfortunately. And these are rare insects. They're hard to find out in the jungles of Panama. And they occur solitary. They're not social. You're not looking for ants. You're looking for something that, you know, could be anywhere. Also, if you look at the anal papillae, you'll find that the spines are directed dorsally rather than ventrally. When I first dissected one of these, I actually had them inverted. I said, wait a minute, the ductus bursa is on the other side, because these spines are projecting dorsally. I think they're probably used to help rake in these seedy, and with the coordination, maybe even the legs even, I don't know, nobody knows, somehow starts this egg being wrapped by the seedy, and we have photographs actually of the eggs coming out of the abdomen, and you can see the process of curling around the egg as the eggs are coming out. I think with that little interesting note, I'll conclude the talk.
Now, did you want to take some questions now, or?
I can't answer anything, but like I say, it's so much you don't know about this group. But yes?
In tortrices, there's an enlargement of the ductus seminalis from the bullous.
A sac-like.
Right.
Yeah, this often happens, and it's a storage.
Okay, because those have these spicules.
They do.
In them, and the ductus seminalis itself has spicules.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Dispersed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one case.
Homologous to anything that you got in the clinic?
No, we don't. In fact, rarely have I encountered bulla seminalis. I see it often in, you know, illustrations and other papers, dietrizy and stuff, but I haven't seen it myself in groups I've worked on. Yeah.
Now, what's the nature of this spermatophore in these things? I guess in Hepialis, it's really sort of non-existent in the sense that it's just sperm put in there and maybe some other secretions.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a persistent structure. You can count the number of
proteins.
Right. So I was just going to ask you.
I think it goes from something, you know, extremely membranous that never leaves a trace. I remember many, many years ago when I was starting, I asked Hinton about this, you know. I said, well, we have lots of Lepidoptera that have no signum, and yet they may have, you know, prominent spermatophores sometimes found. I said, what's going on here? He said, well, that's probably a chemical reaction, and it's a chemical action that's dissolving the spermatophore. Then you have these cases quite the opposite, where the spermatophore just, we never find a trace of one. In fact, most of the groups I work on, I never see a spermatophore. And I assume, you know, something is there as a package, that the sperm is carried over in a package. But, and you read all the textbooks, you know, this is what they say, it's transferred in a package called a spermatophore. But again, there are many, in many groups you find a, it's a very chitinized material. You see lots of remains of them. And, I'm glad you pointed that out. This is the other question I had with the cycads and the Rhenophanes, the Odocatocyne and the Rhenophanes, is that it looks like they're deliberately bypassing the corpus bursae. They're not depositing any sperm in that, but they're putting it closer to the oviduct. Is this a selective behavior? I mean, it's not an accidental thing. With Rhenophanids, it's a quite elaborate development in both males and females. So, but apparently the corpus bursae is not used. But again, all these conjectures have to be substantiated eventually. I don't know. Yes?
You illustrated very often the duck from the sort of feet of the land, and it used it seems to be single in diatrism, but double in the monotrism. Is that a general trend?
The other way, the other way. It's actually in both. In fact, it's often considered a characteristic of the Neolepidoptera, having these dual ducts. But if you go back as far as the heterobathmids, you see evidence of the beginning of a division within the spermatheca duct.
It's a single duct hierarchy system.
Yeah, well, that's something I have not encountered myself. What families? Noctuidae? Imphalids. Just a single duct, and it's not coiled?
It's kind of wiggling around in the abdomen.
Uh-huh. Well, Charlie is really our expert on the spermatheca. He actually did a paper largely on that, and he can vouch on some of the very useful characters often present in this structure. That's often overlooked because it's either torn out and discarded in many preparations, and there's so much membranous material, very weakly sclerotized material, that it's not well preserved. And even in a prepared specimen, you can't see some of the characters you need to see, or the shapes or forms, and you really have to study it in glycerin. That's usually what I try to do before I mount the specimen. Yes?
In Tortrisis, there are two very small sclerites anterior to the anal opening that are small, but they're usually there unless they're torn away in the sexual process.
Uh-huh.
Would those be homologous with that pectoral spheroid you were talking about?
The colliculum or the antrum? In other words, they're in the antrum area?
Right.
The ductus bursae?
They're posterior. I mean, they're anterior to the anal opening on the ventral side of the...
I'd say that's something else. I don't know. I haven't seen that, but I wouldn't consider it part of the antrum. But it's outside. The ostium bursa.
Right.
Yeah.
It's anterior to the ankle.
That's some modification of the 10th membrane or something.
It's a very distinctive spherical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have no idea. I haven't encountered anything like that. Okay, thank you.